Let's generate our motivation. And recall how important it is to respect the spiritual practices and lineages of other Buddhist traditions, as well as other faith traditions, and to seek the commonalities that we share: ethical conduct, love and compassion, forgiveness, and so on. And to encourage people to practice the tradition that is best suited for them. And of course, we want to nudge people towards the Bodhisattva vehicle. But to be sensitive, and if that's not the thing for somebody right now, then at least to support them in what is benefiting them. And so, you know, this thing of really being respectful of others, listening to others, understanding where they're coming from, why they believe what they believe, how that makes sense to them. And in that way, they will help us refine our skillful means, as well as open our mind and become more tolerant. And of course, being open-minded and being more tolerant doesn't mean that we become wishy-washy in what we practice. We can remain firm in what we practice. We need to remain firm, so we'll get somewhere in our practice. But I think it all relates back to the thing that we are all quite different. We're all very similar, and we're all quite different. And to be able to put those two things together. Because in the long term, what we're looking for is really the benefit of all living beings. And not just the benefit in samsara, but really to help everybody get out of samsara. And so tonight is one more drop in that bucket of helping us learn and helping us go in that direction. So we're in the chapter about Buddhist history, you know, which is actually, the chapter is quite brief, and there's a lot of stuff that we still don't know. But within the chapter on Buddhist history, we're learning a little bit about the backgrounds and the interactions of the different Buddhist traditions historically, and how that functioned in previous centuries, and how that influenced and created the cause for how we work together with other Buddhist traditions now in our lives, and even our attitude towards other religions. So it's quite interesting in the root bodhisattva precepts. You know, there's a lot of precepts that concern and you know, how we relate to other traditions. Yeah, have you thought about that? You know, that, you know, we shouldn't criticize the Mahayana and tell people Mahayana is useless and it's too difficult, so better to practice fundamental vehicle. We shouldn't do that. On the other hand, we shouldn't say to fundamental vehicle practitioners, you'll never get rid of your afflictions practicing that. You should practice the Mahayana. And also, you know, we shouldn't criticize the Mahayana and teach something that sounds like it, but is our own made-up stuff. Nor should we criticize any of the teachings of the three vehicles that the Buddha taught and make up stuff that sounds similar, you know, preaching our own dharma. Okay, so there's lots of things in here about, you know, how to relate to other traditions and yet at the same time remain firm in our own tradition without wavering. Yeah. And it's sentient beings, we have a hard time being tolerant and open-minded because we tend to have this belief of, you know, what I believe is the best, otherwise I wouldn't believe it. And so if what I believe is the best, then everybody should believe what I believe. Okay, and if they don't, then they're wrong. And then if you have, quote, quote, compassion, then you're going to try and save them out of your compassion because what they believe is wrong and you have the one right view. Yeah. Or you're just going to throw these people away as heretics who are not going to amount to anything. And so you see how in the world we get so messed up. You know, because of religious beliefs. And I think the real solution to this is seeing that, you know, different people need different practices and philosophies at different times in their growth. Yeah. And so not having this one size fits all mentality. Yeah. Because what happens when we get, you know, well, what I believe is right, and so this is the right thing. What's behind that is a lot of insecurity, I think, and, you know, a correct assumption or doubt, but no inference or direct perceivers. Yeah, because, you know, why do we insist that other people have to practice as we do? Because underneath it, we feel really insecure, you know, and we're not sure if our own belief is right. Yeah. Whereas I think if we have an inference, if we have a direct perceiver, then we're confident in our belief and we don't need everybody else to think like we do, to have confidence in what we believe. So do you see how this thing of being closed-minded around religion is very much related to attachment to praise and aversion to blame? Yeah, we want other people's approval of what we believe. Yeah. And then we feel comfortable. Oh, if everybody else agrees, this is good. And they believe like I believe, then I don't have to worry about thinking that maybe my beliefs aren't correct. Yeah. No, why would we worry that our beliefs aren't correct? Because there's no inference, there's no direct perceivers. Yeah. And there's even kind of a shaky assumption. You know, I mean, there's many levels of assumption. And if we had a very firm, correct assumption, we wouldn't shake that much. But, you know, when we have, our correct assumption is like jello, then what supports it is the number of people who say, I believe like you believe. And then we think, well, if they believe that, then the more people who believe that, then we all must be right. Yeah, you getting what I'm saying? So it's kind of, you know, the emperor, what is it? The emperor has no clothes, you know? You just go along with the crowd and then you feel secure. Whereas I think if we, are really able to think deeply and really see that different people need different things at different times, then we feel comfortable giving people space to have their beliefs without us shaking in our shoes because what they believe is different from us, okay? At the same time, you know, if people are open and receptive, we want to encourage them in the path of ethical conduct, love and compassion, tolerance, and, you know, in the Buddhist community, kind of, you know, nudge them a little bit towards a bodhisattva vehicle. But doing all this with complete respect and knowledge that, you know, people will progress when they're ready to. Yeah? And so not to like push them along. Okay. So I think that's an interesting thing to keep in mind as we're reading about Buddhist history and all these different traditions and how they came about and what people's views are about them. Because even in academia, the views are changing nowadays. And of course, you know, the different traditions all have ideas about the other traditions and, you know. Okay. So we were on page 82. Early Buddhism in Sri Lanka. Okay, so we had been talking about before early Buddhism in India. Okay, and how there were 18 schools, but actually more than 18 schools, but everybody agreed there were 18. And how they all had different languages, and they all probably had different versions of the Tripitaka, of the Vinaya, the Sutra, and the Abhidharma. Yeah. And a lot of this happened simply because of geography. You know, people were so spread out. You know, the Banakas, I'm sure they had their rules for establishing, you know, what they considered was the Buddha's word. But because it was an oral tradition and people were thousands of miles apart, you know, differences came about. It's very natural that that happens. Okay, so in talking about early Buddhism in Sri Lanka, you know, this is when you study Buddhist history, this is one of the first things you hear about, okay, is how Buddhism went south to Sri Lanka. And it's interesting because the Sri Lankans have really kept a lot of historical records. And so, you know, well, whereas ever there's a lot of material, people's attention goes there. So all these schools that existed in India, we don't have a lot of records because it was written on birch bark or something like that, and it wasn't consistently copied, and then there were, you know, drought and famines and wars and everything. And so we don't know much, so not a lot of attention goes there in terms of thinking about what they did. Okay, but Sri Lanka, very good with history. China, not bad. Very good, actually, in terms of keeping historical records. Tibet? Yeah? That wasn't their speciality. Okay, so Buddhism was transmitted to Sri Lanka by the son and daughter of the Indian king Ashoka in the 3rd century BCE. Yeah, so can you imagine you're king and you had a son who's a monk and a daughter who's a nun, and you put them both on a ship and send them to an island, you know, and hope they would get there. And they both did, and they wound up setting up the monastic traditions for the monks and for the nuns there. Okay, so of course there were others besides his son and daughter, you know, because you need a certain number of monks and a certain number of nuns to give the ordination. But he was quite something. Ashoka, I mean, in general, was amazing. He was quite vicious at first, you know, as a king. I mean, he was this great warrior, and he conquered all this and killed so many people. And I can't remember the whole story. I don't know. Does anybody remember how it was that he went from that to he had some kind of great experience?
He walked the battlefield.
He kept pushing
to expand his empire, and he pushed and he pushed and he pushed. And I don't know what sparked this particular walk, but he walked this battlefield and saw all the carcasses as far as he could see, and he was just sick.
Yeah.
That this is what he had done for what?
Yeah.
And that's how he turned to the Dharma.
Yeah. There was something also, some kind of vision or something, too. Or what? Anyway, maybe somebody who wants to look it up between now and then? Okay. Yeah. Do you remember? Or? Yeah, okay.
I remember that we can look for.
Okay. Okay, there's some story. Anyway, he had this experience where he said, you know, he just was like full of regret for all these people that he had killed. Yeah. And then he began to really propagate Buddhism in his empire. And he built all these stone monuments and put Buddhist sayings on them. And if you look at Indian currency today, they all have this pillar with the lion's heads on top. That's one of King Ashoka's pillars. Okay, so he made these all over the land and tried to spread the Dharma. It was really quite something. Yeah. There's also some story when the Buddha was alive, he was a child, and he offered gold, and he put that in the Buddha's alms bowl, and that's how he became a king. Something I'm not real good on all these kind of stories. What? Oh, it was sand that he imagined as gold. That's right. Yes. Yeah.
He imagined it.
Gold. And didn't he stand on the shoulders of the other kids or something to reach the Buddha's bowl? Yeah, anyway, somebody, if you could look it up, okay, and tell us the whole story of King Ashoka. Okay. But undoubtedly, I mean, he was quite something. Okay. So some of the Indian commentaries came too, and they were preserved and augmented in the old Sinhala language by Sinhalese monks. Okay, so some of the sutras came, and the Indian commentaries, the very old Indian commentaries, and then in Sri Lanka they started writing their own commentaries. So all the commentaries were in Sinhalese. I don't know what language the sutras themselves were in when they first went to Sri Lanka. In the 5th century CE, the Indian monk Buddhaghosa traveled to Sri Lanka, where he compiled and edited the contents of these ancient commentaries when writing his own numerous commentaries in Pali. Okay, so he was the one who put everything in Pali. And some scholars speculate that the reason he did that was because Sanskrit already in northern India was like the language, the Buddha, language of the Buddhist scriptures and of the intelligentsia. And so they felt in the south they needed, you know, their own language for the scriptures and the intelligentsia. That's what some people say. I don't know if it's true, but. Okay, so while Buddhaghosa's works have been widely studied up until the present, the ancient sages' scriptures in Sinhala unfortunately no longer exist because they were written on birch bark. Due to Buddhaghosa's translation work, Pali became the scriptural language of all Theravada Buddhists. Buddhism flourished in Sri Lanka, and three major sects, the Mahavihara, Abhayagiri, and Jetavana evolved, each with its own monastery. Okay. So Chinese pilgrims recorded that Abhayagiri, the largest and wealthiest monastery, followed both the early scriptures and the Mahayana scriptures. Okay. And some of the Mahayana sutras in the Chinese Tripitaka were obtained in Sri Lanka. So remember I was saying that you have all these agamas in the Chinese canon that are very close to the Nikayas in the Pali canon. Okay, so some of the Mahayana sutras in the Chinese Tripitaka were obtained in Sri Lanka. You know, so that's how you could trace, one way you can trace, you know, the origin of the agamas. There were also many bodhisattva statues and Mahayana art on the island, and there's evidence that some tantric teachings were present there as well. Okay, so when Mahayana became popular, it spread throughout India, it spread into Sri Lanka, you know, and into Southeast Asia. They don't like to talk about that now. Okay, and as we keep reading, you'll see why. Okay, when a dispute arose between the Abhayagiri and Jetavana monasteries on one side, both of which had some Mahayana elements, and the Mahavihara on the other side, who said that the Mahayana sutras were not authentic, King Mahasena, so he's in the 3rd century, supported Abhayagiri and Jetavana, so nothing like having the king on your side. Okay, but after he died, after that king died, the Mahavihara sect gained the royal support. Okay, and as the collection of written scriptures grew, the Mahavihara gained more legitimacy as the holder of pure Buddhism, free from the heterodox ideas and scriptures found in Abhayagiri and Jetavana. Okay, so some benefits of having the king on your side. Yeah. And you can see this historically with all religions. It's like, you know, you need to have the king on your side if you want to thrive as a religion. Christianity, it was really like that. Yeah. And this is one of the things that really messed up Latin America very much. You know, the relationship between the church and the state and, you know, all the stuff that was going on in Europe, all the wars that went on, you know, a lot of them because of this relationship between church and state. Yeah. And when Buddhism also went to China, it had to be very, very, very careful because, you know, the Confucians were in, you know, very involved in the bureaucracy in China. And when the Buddhists came in, you know, the Confucians weren't really hot about having the Buddhists around. And You know, so on one hand, the Buddhists needed the support of the government. On the other hand, they had to stay away and not incense the Confucianists. So it was a touchy kind of thing, you know, and also from the Buddhist side, they really didn't want to get involved in all the political goings on. That was one reason they went out to the mountains, the Zen people, you know, the Chan people went out to the mountains. But on the other hand, if they wanted to continue to exist, you know, they needed royal support. So always, you know, throughout history, with all religions, there's always this kind of stickiness. The Buddha, you know, when the Buddha was alive, and the way that, you know, he wanted it was he didn't want the secular government messing with the monastic community. And so the Vinaya, in some ways, was like, that was the legal system for the monastic community. And the idea was you don't, you know, they take care of themselves, and he didn't want the heads of state messing with the monastics. And there's good reason for that, because if you have lay people governing the monastics, you know, it's not going to turn out well, because the lay people have a totally different view of life, and they're thinking about this life, and they're thinking about money and prestige and so on and so forth. And the monastics have other goals, yeah. So you need the support of the government, but you kind of don't want it too much. Yeah, it's yeah. So you know, when the Buddha was alive, he was the teacher of these various kings, and so they respected him, and you know, and he helped them and so on. But they didn't mess with the Buddha. But when the Buddha was no longer there, then, you know, it became more difficult. Yeah. So, I mean, historically, this idea of separation of church and state is really quite a marvelous idea. You know, it didn't come about until just a few centuries ago. And you can see how difficult it is. You know, even in this country, how some people want their religious views to be the law of the land, you know, and they don't want separation of church and state. They want their church to be affiliated with the state, okay, which really makes a mess in a country where you have so many different religions, yeah. So this has always been a tension in every country, you know, in all times. Yeah, quite difficult. Okay, so this is why I think, you know, in the U.S. in our times, we have to watch very closely the relationship between church and state. And when things start getting blurry, we need to speak up. Yeah? Yeah, I think that's very important. If we just start letting, you know, one thing and one thing and one thing, you know. For example, yeah, I don't think it's right that they have the words "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance. That was only put in the Pledge of Allegiance in the last century. It hasn't always been in there. I don't think it should be in there. I don't think it should be on the U.S. currency. Yeah. Because, yeah, there's many people in this country who don't believe in God. Okay. So, you know, I've always wondered, you know, if you go to court and, you know, they usually, you have to swear on a Bible. Yeah. I mean, what happens if you say, no, I won't swear on a Bible? Well, yeah, you don't have to. Oh, you can use another text. Oh, that's good. Okay. Yeah. Because otherwise... Yeah, right. The Bodhicharya Avatara. So yeah. Yeah. But I remember when my nephew, when he was 5 years old, they took me to, you know, they wanted to take me to a school and show me a school and everything. And he was so proud and he wanted us all to recite the Pledge of Allegiance together. And I just kind of froze because I didn't want to say, you know, one nation under God. And also I didn't want to pledge allegiance to a flag. A flag is a piece of cloth. How do you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? You know, pledge allegiance to the, you know, to some of the values that are written in the Constitution in the way that they should be lived, even though our founders didn't have that idea when they wrote them. yeah, which took me some years to figure out. Yeah, those values, I think, are wonderful. But, you know, allegiance to a flag? Yeah. So, but, you know, symbols are quite important. You know, we saw when they started burning flags during the Vietnam War era, people were freaking out. Yeah. Anyway. Buddhism floor, okay, I read that. Yeah, so there was Mahayana influence as well as Tantric influence in Sri Lanka. So the Dipavamsa, which means the island chronicle, and the Mahavamsa, which means the great chronicle, these are texts written in Sri Lanka, presented Buddhist history according to the narrative of the Mahavihara. So you tell history according to your version of history. Yeah. And then, of course, people who read the text, we know that, you know, if you've ever studied history, yeah, you read what people write, and it's always, you know, what they happen to be interested in and what they think is important, you know, and you pick and choose the details and you construct the story according to what you want other people to believe. And, you know, this is happening even in the news when we hear the news, which remind me, I have some to tell you at the end of when we're over. okay. So the Dipavamsa was probably authored by Mahavihara monks in the 3rd or 4th century and the Mahavihamsa in the second half of the 5th century. Their authors claim to be the true Theravadins, the spiritual descendants of arhats of the First Council. So that's how they saw themselves, you know, in the same way that the Tibetans have their version. You know, how did the Tibetans race come about? Because Chenrezig, who was he the monkey or the ogress? A monkey and an ogress mated, and the result was the Tibetan people. I forget, Chenrezig was one of them. He was the monkey? Okay, and I don't know who the ogress was. Huh? I don't know. So anyway, yeah, so they have their whole thing in the Sakya lineage, you know. It says that they're descended from certain god realms that came down and mated with human beings. And, yeah, I mean, you know how it is. everybody has their story about their own special origin, how their people began. Okay. So these historical chronicles also spoke of the lineage of Sri Lankan kings and events occurring during their reigns. They also spoke of mythology and legend. They portrayed Sri Lanka as the island where the Buddha prophesied that his teachings would be purely preserved, thus encouraging a nationalistic spirit. Of course, the Tibetans said the same thing about the land of Tibet. And, you know, everybody claimed the Buddha for themselves. Why don't we start something like that too, you know? Find something in one of the scriptures. Yeah. Oh, wasn't it that the thing, what's his name? Padmasambhava. Yeah, you know, who said when the iron bird flies. And yeah, so claim that. So, you know, we have the, you know. Yeah, right. You know, and it's flying here to America. So we were prophesized. And, you know, it's very interesting how throughout human history, this is another thing that human beings have done is, you know, they find things in previous historical chronicles or in myths or in legends or religious stories that prophesized the special things that are happening now in their own country, you know. And so people use that to legitimize, you know, what is happening now. So, I was just thinking, did somebody prophesize Trump? maybe who?
Nostradamus,
yeah. Yeah. But it's interesting. I mean, it's telling us something about how the human mind works, okay? That we feel that we have to substantiate what we believe in by having a story that has some spiritual, mythical dimension of things that are holy and beyond us human beings. Yeah? And then science comes along and tears all that apart and says, no, you know? We're just bunches of vegetable goo, and we came from the apes. And, you know, before that, we came from the bacteria in the ocean. And all your stories in your different countries about how you came from the gods and from these special beings and everything you are was prophesized. Then science comes along and says, that's all. Mm. So forget it. You know, I mean, think of how traumatic that was for civilization when that happened. And how, you know, we like to think, well, science won out. But you look and no, not really. You know, people, this spiritual something beyond what we can see is really draws people. Yeah. And you can control them through making that kind of story. Of course, I think you could probably control people by making the story that we came from the apes and the viruses too. Yeah, it's not quite as glamorous, but yeah. But yeah, for me, all of this is just telling you something about the human mind and how we work, you know. And the reason I think that's important is to ask ourselves, what is the basis of my faith in the Buddha Dharma? Okay? Is the basis of my faith the fact that, you know, the Buddha was born from the side of King Maya when she was leaning against a tree, you know, and that, you know, she knew she was pregnant because she dreamt that an elephant entered into her womb, and, you know, that the Buddha, when he came out of the womb, he raised his hand and he took three steps and he said, this is my last life. You know, is seven steps. Isn't that what I said? Three. I meant seven. Don't you know what I mean? You should know what I mean without me having to say it. So, you know, is this the basis of our faith in the Buddha, that these kinds of things happened? Yeah. Why do we have faith in the Buddha? Yeah. Do we feel more comfortable with our own particular lineage because of the stories we hear about the previous masters doing magical things? Yeah, is that what gives us faith in our lineages? Is the stories that we hear, you know, Padmasambhava raining these stones down and getting rid of all the bad spirits? And, you know, poor Shantarakshita, all he did was start the monastic community, but, you know, he didn't do anything magical. But you go to Samye. I have one of those stones, actually. You go to Samye and you see these very interesting looking stones. And they say these are the ones that, you know, Padmasambhava made rain down on the area to get rid of all the spirits. But, you know, and that may have some truth in it. I don't know. I don't know if spirits exist or not. I think they do. But don't ask me to prove it. But what I'm trying to get at is to ask ourselves, you know, why do we believe what we believe? Yeah. And how do we substantiate what we believe to ourselves and to other people? Yeah. How much do we rely on supernatural things? So I know, hold on, for myself, you know, if my faith depended on supernatural things, there would be no reason for me to be Buddhist, you know, because the tradition I grew up with as a child had enough miracles in it, you know, if that's what established my faith, it had plenty of miracles. I mean, can you beat the parting of the Red Sea? Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty spectacular miracle, isn't it? Yeah, and the burning bush and all those kinds of things. So is that where, you know, if that's where my faith comes from, yeah, did I just change from, you know, Jewish miracles to Buddhist miracles? Yeah, and how do we feel when our Tibetan teachers talk about miraculous things? Yeah, does it, for some people, for some Westerners, I think it really inspires faith. And for other Westerners, they just kind of sit there like it's stories, you know, because people are very different and they have different needs and different things. But what I'm getting at is to ask ourselves, you know, what is the foundation of my faith in what I practice?
To build on what you're saying, I think that there's some tension as Buddhism has come to the United States. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are drawn to it, and myself included, because it seemed very rational. It's based on evidence. It doesn't require, you know, belief based on faith or, you know, a lot of irrational things. But at the same time, people, like you were saying, science doesn't provide anything that really nourishes the heart. So mm-hmm. you really feel at a loss kind of with the bigger picture and your purpose in life. So, yeah, I think people are drawn to Buddhism for different reasons, but even like within one practitioner, they could struggle, you know, believing some of the more far out claims like miracles and
yeah.
things like that, even though like what the Buddha says, a lot of it can be proven directly through experience. And the secular Buddhism movement, I think mm-hmm. they've really kind of, that's one of the reasons why they existed, because there's a lot of people in this country who are very uncomfortable with, you know, miracles and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's very true. And another thing I think we have to look at is how has Buddhism been presented to the West? You know, because I think and I think we'll come to this in a few pages, is, you know, when the Western academia first made contact in Sri Lanka, okay, you know, they saw things and whatever, but then they made, what they conveyed back to the West was something very rational and like this, and we see this now. You know, that in many ways, you know, Buddhism, it's very rational, it's very scientific, and Theravada is presented that way, you know, Tibetan less so. Yeah, because Tibetan has this, it's the one that's like Shangri-La, and, you know, really mysterious and stuff like that. But Theravada is presenting, you know, this completely rational. But when I was in Ithaca, New York some years ago, I met a woman. She was Thai, a history historian, and she had written two books. I wonder if we still have them in our library. I hope so. They were fascinating. She wrote about the development of the Theravada tradition in Thailand and the transformation that happened in the Sangha. And what is so interesting is, you know, we know our Thai Theravada forest monastic friends from Abhayagiri and, you know, Chithurst and so on. And we know, you know, things are presented very rational, very down to earth and so on. But their spiritual ancestors like Achan Moon and, you know, a lot of these people, especially during the 19th century, you know, the forest tradition was in the villages, and they were doing exorcisms, they were placating ghosts, they were, you know, they were the doctors who got rid of spirits who were causing diseases. So they were doing all this stuff that now we look at and we say, well, that's just kind of, you know, what do we say? Kind of, huh?
Shamanism.
Yeah, shamanism, you know, shamanism. You know, that's what traditional cultures practice, yeah? But those are just maybe one or two generations removed from our friends who have a totally different take on what Buddhism is and present it in a completely different way. Yeah? And so, you know, how Buddhism is presented to people in different places at different times according to the cultures. Yeah? But her books were so interesting, reading that. We should look. Venerable Yeshe, do you remember? Are they two? Yeah. If we don't have them, we should see if we can get them. They were something I found very interesting to read. No, from before. Okay.
Do you know the names of the
author? Oh, one long Thai name. I think it starts with a T, but I can't remember exactly. You all know I'm not very good with names. So, yeah. Anyway, you know, and just then, you know, what happened in the middle of the 19th century when they started, you know, organizing the Sangha in Bangkok and establishing a study program and imposing this on all the village monasteries. But the village monasteries were doing what village monasteries do all over the world, you know. And then in Thailand, when they started cutting down the forest, so the forest tradition couldn't live in the forest as much as before. And then what happened to their tradition? So, yeah, quite interesting. Okay. Where were we? Okay. Okay, so they, claiming that other monasteries followed sutras that were not from the original transmission of sutras to Sri Lanka, and thus were not the Buddha's word, the Mahaviharans emphasized that they held the one true canon with the complete Buddha Vakana, or the Buddha's word, free from the degenerations of Mahayana present in the Abhayagiri and Jetavana monasteries. Okay, so there was some rivalry for who had the pure Buddhism. Kind of like, you know, what happened between the Eastern Church and the Western Church, and then between the Catholics and the Protestants, and, you know. Yeah, and the Orthodox and the conservative Jews. And, I mean, yeah, and the Shiites and the Sunnis. And yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, this is just, it's just amazing how human beings are. Okay. So the Dharma developed in Sri Lanka over several centuries with the appearance of written sutras and commentaries, the formation of a closed canon of scriptures, the establishment of authoritative commentaries, and the creation of official histories in the two chronicles. Okay, so they started to get their story organized. Yeah. While helping to preserve the Dharma in Sri Lanka, these factors also served to legitimize and reinforce the authority of the Mahavihara sect as the one that preserved the true Dharma with authentic scriptures. Hmm? So, you know, you create documents, yeah, and you form a body of knowledge, and then you present yourself, and that's how you get known. We were talking a while ago about how we really need at the Abbey to you know, have better records of what we do. Yeah, because we just kind of live it and we don't keep all the records and everything. But, you know, sometimes somebody is going to come along and do their PhD dissertation. And they're going to say, why didn't these people keep good records? You know, or another thing we were talking about when we were traveling is the whole thing about trying to establish the Bhikshuni ordination in the West. And we've noticed that our Theravada Bhikkhuni friends, you know, they have their whole story written out. It was put in one of the Shakyadita newsletters. But our tradition, we don't have, you know, everything put out step by step, all the different meetings that have happened, all the different papers that have been written, the different conclusions, the different ordinations, and when they've been given and how things have been started. We don't have one centralized record of all of that, you know. And we were thinking, you know, it's not that old, and we really should kind of put it together. So this is, you know, what I had asked Venerable Champa to do. But it involves some digging, you know, even though it's only 20, 30 years. Huh?
We're Tibetan.
What do you mean? We're very Tibetan.
How we deal with history.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Except we don't present it in 60-year cycles. You know, kind of, you know, in the Earth Pig year, we had 19 monastics doing Varsa together. Yeah, so we kind of, yeah, it'd be good if we got kind of, you know, some of that. But, so it's good historically to have it, but then it also is a thing of constructing, you know, a history and you know, so it'll be challenging if we do this. Like if you look at all the Bhikshuni things, you know, are there certain things that happened here and there that, you know, maybe we want to just kind of leave out of the history? You know? Yeah, you know, so and so over here, what they were doing, you know, it's like, can we leave that out? Or should we put it in? Or, yeah.
At the Varsa ceremony where we take count every year, is that recorded somewhere?
No.
That would be an easy thing to record, how many people were here for.
Yeah.
For.
Right, yeah. So we have a great
picture. Until the internet goes down.
Read the annual report.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when somebody asked us what year did we start doing Posada in, I can't tell you. You know, it was when, as soon as we had four Bhikshunis, but I can't tell you what year that was in. 2011. Oh, I'm glad you guys know. Yeah. Hmm? Okay. Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, okay. But what's interesting here, okay, is where was okay. So what this? Oh no, we're up here, aren't we? Okay. So while the Mahavihara gained momentum, it did not become dominant until the 10th century. So it had the king's support, but the Abhayagiri and Jetavana were still there. But by the 10th century, it became dominant in the 10th century. And by the 12th century, King Parakamabahu, quote, unified all the monks, okay, just as kings usually unify people by, you know, threatening everybody who doesn't join his side. Okay, so what he did, he unified all the monks by suppressing the Abhayagiri and Jetavana monasteries and their texts and called for their monks either to disrobe or to join the Mahavihara. Okay, so it was like, it's our way or the highway, guys. You know, but then when you look in Tibetan history and you have when the Gelugs became more powerful and, what happened with the Kargyu tradition, what happened with the Jonang tradition, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. They were gone. Yeah, because there had been, I think it's coming up soon, but around that time, there was the Chola invasion. The Cholas were people from South India, and they went into Sri Lanka. They also went into like Sumatra and around that area as well. And so they kind of knocked out Buddhism. And so they knocked out the Bhikshu and the Bhikshuni lineage in Sri Lanka. The king asked for some bhikshus to come from, was it Thailand or Burma? I think from Burma, to come back, to come to Sri Lanka, give the ordination there to restore the bhikshu lineage in Sri Lanka. But there had never been any bhikshunis in Burma, so they couldn't restore that lineage. Although Ayati says that she's found some indications that there may have been bhikshunis a long time ago in Thailand, but nobody seemed to know much about them before. So, people don't write much about the nuns. Yeah. So that's why we have to write our herstory. Okay. It is not clear what the term Theravada referred to historically or when it came into common use. While it is often presented nowadays as referring to the original Buddhism, in fact, the term Theravada is rarely found in Pali literature, and for the first millennium of the Buddha's dispensation, it was used infrequently in inscriptions, historical chronicles, or other ancient texts in Southeast Asia. You know, and what they're finding too in a lot of these texts that they're newly finding in Pakistan and Afghanistan, these ones that are, very, very old, in those texts also, they very infrequently mention their tradition. Yeah, so it's interesting because it seems like tradition, your lineage was not a big thing. They didn't put it in all their scriptures. Yeah, and so here, same thing with the Theravada is rarely found in Pali literature. And for the first millennium of the Buddha's dispensation, it was used infrequently in inscriptions, historical chronicles, or other ancient texts in Southeast Asia. Interestingly, I think this is interesting here. It seems the term Theravada first appeared in Nagarjuna Koda in southeastern India. I think that's also where they say, isn't that the place where the Buddha gave the Kalachakra initiation? Somewhere around there? Yeah, I think so. Okay, that term appeared, you know, in Nagarjuna Koda in southeastern India, where proto-Mahayana views were promulgated. Chinese pilgrims called the Sri Lankan monks living there Mahayana Theravadins. Now, you know, get that. Mahayana Theravadins. Yeah, that's what I would call Bhikkhu Bodhi. Okay, but this is what, you know, they were calling some of the Sri Lankans in southeastern India. The term Theravada does not seem to have indicated a school in India prior to Buddhism having gone to Sri Lanka, but a school originating in Sri Lanka. Okay, so one of the 18 schools, when you divide them, you know, as into categories, one of the major categories is the Staviravada, and they say that that's a Sanskrit term for Theravada, you know, and so then people say, well, see, you know, it goes all the way back to that time to the Staviravadas, but, you know, what they're finding now is, you know, the term Theravada does not seem to have indicated a school in India prior to Buddhism having gone to Sri Lanka, but as a school originating in Sri Lanka. Yeah, that's quite interesting because, you know, they built this whole history in the two chronicles, you know, based on, you know, Buddhism was prophesied, or Sri Lanka was prophesied by the Buddha. We're the descendants of the people from the first council, you know, way back in India when Kassapa called everybody together after the Buddha passed away. So they describe their own history that way. But then the term Theravada doesn't seem to fit their described history. But, you know, this is human beings, isn't it?
I find it interesting that in Sri Lanka, there was one sect called Abhayagiri, mm-hmm. and yet that's the name of the most famous Theravadin center in this country.
Yeah.
Yeah, and yet it was associated with Mahayana then.
Yeah. So, but you know, there's some of the monks who go to that monastery in California that have taken the Bodhisattva vows. Because I was with them at His Holiness's teachings when they did that. Oh, yeah. Actually, what we gave them, you know, Jen's picture of our Kuan Yin? Yeah, we gave them the file for it, and Nisabu, you know, printed it out, and they framed it, and they have it somewhere. Yeah. Yeah, but look at us. We have statues from China, from Burma. Yeah, I mean this is what happens very organically when, you know, different people come together as they adopt things from different cultures and, yeah. Okay, I mean look at us and how many retreats have we done. With the four establishments of monastery. Of establishments of mindfulness, you know, which, you know, His Holiness says He really wished more people in our tradition practice, but very few people practice. But look at us. We do it and people love the practice. Yeah. So you can see, you know, just in your own life, how things influence each other and, you know, traditions and so on change. And then you have, you know, like in Luminary Temple, they, some of their nuns went to Burma and they learned, you know, the Vipassana meditation towards that there, and that's what they're doing. And when I go to Luminary Temple, she wants to get me to give a talk on the five treatises that we study in the Tibetan tradition. Yeah. So, I mean, look how things just very naturally cross-pollinate, don't they? You know, and we learn from each other. And thing, you know, people adapt things. Okay.
I just wondered if you had read anything about maybe some of these monastics from those two suppressed monasteries in Sri Lanka might have gone to India. To Nagarjuna.
Yeah.
I mean, what, this expression, Mahayana Theravada.
Theravada, yeah.
It was. Yeah, Mahayana Theravada.
Yeah, maybe they did. I don't know. I haven't read anything.
If you're going to have to disrobe, you might think about leaving.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah, they might have done that. Yeah. Historically, Theravada has not been a monolithic religious or institutional entity in South or Southeast Asia. While people in that area initially received their monastic ordinations from Sri Lanka, the sanghas that grew up in these locales functioned independently. When the ordination lineage was extinguished in Sri Lanka during the Chola invasion in the early 11th century, Sri Lankan kings requested monks from Burma to come and restore it. This began a trend in South and Southeast Asia that continues to this day. Whenever a group of monastics is deemed corrupt, the king invites monastics from another Theravada country who practice well to come and give the ordination again. Yeah. Still, the Sri Lankan ordination lineage commands great respect, and monks from other countries traveled to Sri Lanka to ordain in later centuries. Okay, so just as in Tibet, you know, due to war and political stuff, the monastic lineage was cut, and then it was restored. Mm-hmm. In recent years, academics have revised their idea that the Theravada tradition contains the oldest and most authentic scriptures of the 18 schools. Some say Theravada is a modern term and a recent school derived from the Stavaravadins, but not identical to it. Others say Theravada is descendant from the Mahavihara or was derived from the Indian school, the Vibhajayavada. Okay, let's see what that footnote, that end note says. Because I remember writing, this is the note from Bhikkhu Bodhi. Okay. Okay, so he wrote to Jhampa Sedrinla, Theravada refers to a modern school of Buddhism, so he says modern school of Buddhism, which derives from the old Stavaravada, but the latter has a much longer history and is the source of many of the old Indian schools that did not survive. It would be misleading to simply assume that Theravada is identical with Stavaravada, and the latter simply a Sanskritized form signifying exactly what the former means. Okay. I also don't think it is suitable to identify Theravadas as Mahaviharans. The reason this came up is that in one of the Tibetan traditions, when they divided the different 18 schools, I think under the category of Staviravada, they had Mahavihara, Jetavani, and Abhayagiri. You know, because those were the previous ones, okay? And so that's how the Tibetans identified them. And so when two got knocked out, oh, those are, you know, it's the Mahaviharans who practice in Sri Lanka. And so as Bhikkhu Bodhi is saying, I also don't think it's suitable to identify Theravadins as Mahaviharans. The latter term, Mahaviharans, was meaningful during the period in Sri Lanka when the schools of Buddhism were named after the viharas, or monasteries, where they were centered. In that era, Mahaviharans referred to those based on the Mahavihara in Anuruddhapura. They were distinguished by their particular attitude towards Buddha's texts and methods of interpretation preserved in the Pali commentaries. But nowadays, all that is left of the Mahavihara are its runes. And what we call Theravada has evolved in more complex ways than the old Mahaviharans could ever have foreseen. Yeah? So I imagine the same thing, could be said for Sangha Rakshita, you know, when he brought Buddhism to Tibet and established the monasteries there. You know, how similar is that to what is going on today? Yeah. And because also in that time when he came, you know, the schools, we didn't even have the old translation and the new translation division. And in the new translation, we didn't have the Sakya and Kargyu and Gelu.
So this person says that apparently some records show Sinhala bhikkhunis from the Abhayagiri Vihara in Anuruddhapura were responsible for the establishment of an order of Buddhist nuns in China in the 5th century.
Yeah. So they're not sure. I don't know if they're sure which monastery, you know, where they came from, because certainly the nuns would not be living in the same monastery as the monks. But the Chinese Bhikshuni lineage, the first dual ordination came about because nuns, Bhikshunis from Sri Lanka, traveled on a boat to China, learned Chinese, and then gave the ordination together there with Chinese monks. And that's how you had the first dual ordination in China. Yeah. Before the dual ordination, there was one nun who was ordained by the monks, you know, a single Sangha ordination. So she was about a century earlier. Yeah. Yeah. And then what's very interesting is you had in 1998, the master from Foquan Shan organizing a dual ordination in Bodh Gaya, where the Chinese Bhikshunis gave ordination to some of the Dasasilmatas from Sri Lanka, so that they became Bhikshunis. Yeah, but they didn't want to be Bhikshunis from the Dharmaguptaka tradition, so the Theravada monks took them to Sarnath and reordained them, so that somehow they made them into Theravada bhikkhunis, so that then they could go back to Sri Lanka and reinvigorate the bhikkhuni ordination there. Yeah? They were lucky, you know, because they had some monks who were really willing to do this. Yeah, the Tibetan is very conservative. Huh? They're a different lineage. Yeah. Okay. So much of the Pali literature consists of the commentaries and sub-commentaries that were compiled or written beginning in the 5th century. So that was with Buddhaghosa. The Pali scriptures were transmitted in different scripts according to the country. Yeah, and the Sanskrit was too. The scripts that it was written in was different. The words were pronounced and recited differently, and this is true even today. Remember I told you, in Bodh Gaya, when they had the recitation, they had it according to country. Different lineages and nikayas or traditions developed in each country. The monks also were not unified and were not a unified whole. Those who dwelled in the cities and in the forests lived very differently, and they still do today in Theravada countries, quite different. Nevertheless, most Buddhists in South and Southeast Asia saw themselves as related in many ways, even though a unifying and common identity as Theravadins may not have developed until the 20th century, probably due to modern communication and to Western influence and having to come together to identify themselves as something in the rest of the world. For example, previously in Thailand, the Buddhism in Sri Lanka was called Sinhalese Sasana, the doctrine in Sinhala. Okay, so it was according, they didn't say, oh, those are Theravadas, they practice Sinhala Sasana. Skilling says the centering of Theravada in the Pali Canon, above all in the four major Nikayas, is a child of the late 19th and 20th centuries. It has grown up to become what we might call a new Theravada, largely Anglophonic, but increasingly international in influence and outreach. Whoa! Yeah? Do you realize what he's saying there? Okay. I mean, just how much Theravada has changed in how it's presenting itself to the world and how it thinks of itself now. Okay. And that this is a child of the late 19th century and the 20th centuries, and how much it's been influenced by the Western culture. Some scholars state that the standard account of Sri Lankan Buddhist history was made not by Sri Lankans, but by Buddhist scholars of the early to mid... What? Didn't I say British? God. I'm going nuts. Okay. I'm glad you're reading it. Some scholars state that the standard account of Sri Lankan Buddhist history was made not by Sri Lankans, but by British scholars of the early to mid-19th century who misread the historical chronicles and lacked the knowledge of Buddhist and Sri Lankan history that is now available. Reading the commentaries and chronicles, these scholars assumed that they were objective narratives of the facts, not understanding that Mahaviharan accounts of Buddhist history were disputed by their contemporaries in the Abhayagiri and Jetavana monasteries centuries and centuries ago. Okay, so, here you have Western scholars coming in. They hear something. They say, oh, this is God's truth. And God's, this is the history, how it is, undisputed. When it's actually, the account of one perspective that happened to win the king's favor, but that was disputed even at the time it existed. Why Sinhalese historical documents have portrayed the Pali Canon as equivalent to early Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism, as the unique upholder of early Buddhism, scholars now question this. Okay, so this is how the scholars all thought at the beginning. They adopted this thing of Theravada is the pure teachings of the Buddha, the unique upholder of Buddhism, and everything else was, you know, made up afterwards. Okay. The Pali Canon is usually presented by Theravada Buddhists as a closed collection of texts that presents the Buddha's words. However, the words Pali, Tripitaka, and Buddhavacana did not originally refer to a closed canon. That's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. And the canon in Sri Lanka wasn't closed until 1,000 years after the Buddha was alive. Yeah, so for 1,000 years, they were in the process of passing things down and accumulating this body that eventually got closed and said, this is the Pali Canon. But there's some slight variations I know in Burma and maybe somewhere else too. There's a few, you know, scriptures that they don't agree on. Apart from some specific texts mentioned in Ashoka's inscriptions, we don't have a clear idea of what texts were recited and thus affirmed as existing by that group of monastic reciters during the various councils and communal recitations. Yeah? So you have, you know, all these banagas reciting things in different places, and the scriptures, you know, didn't have the name of a specific tradition on them. And, you know, we don't have a clear idea what the texts were and what different, you know, banakas in the traditions affirmed as their lineage and what each group, you know, recited together. Yeah. But we think, you know, you go to university and, okay, the people in the Theravada tradition, they do this, da 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 da. But it's not some kind of unified thing. Yeah. It would be like going into and saying, well, all the Tibetan Buddhists, they do like this. So, you know, from the outside, if you're Catholic, you know, that's good enough. That gives you enough information. But if you live within the Tibetan Buddhist world, boy, you know, there's so many different branches. And then each within each branch, I mean, look what's happening now in the West. You know, in Tibet, there used to be Nyingma, Kargya, Gelu, and Sakya. Now, you go to any, you know, many of the cities in the West, you have how many Gelu centers in one city? Okay, how many Sakya centers in that city? How many Kargya centers? How many Nyingma centers? Yeah. And it isn't even by monastery. Now you have the centers according to teachers. Yeah. So, you know, Sarah J. may have how many monasteries from the Gishis in their lineage in, you know, one particular state? Or how many Gelu monasteries do you have in a particular state? Everybody has their own, you know, their own affiliation. Yeah, quite interesting. Yeah, isn't it? It makes you wonder, you know, what's going to happen, you know, if monasteries form just around particular teachers. When those teachers die, then what's happening to the, well, I said monasteries, but nowadays it's Dharma centers, you know, then what happens to those particular places? Actually, one of my friends who was a Thai Theravada monk, he was telling me that in Thailand, a lot of the monasteries get built up when there's a very charismatic and astute teacher who's teaching, then a lot of monks come there. But when that teacher dies, then a lot of the monks go to other places, you know, with other teachers. And that monastery that was really big, you know, gets really small. Yeah, so it's interesting. And I know that happened in China, too, prior to 49. So, yeah, so it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the West. The Pali, let me finish this section. The Pali canon wasn't closed and fixed until the 5th century CE. So for about a millennium after the Buddha, the collection of scriptures was open. While the Banakas had strict standards for what they considered to be the Buddha's teachings, there was some fluidity in the contents of this collection, if for no other reason than differences in geographical locale. In short, some academic scholars now question three facts presented in the Mahavihara literature. So one, that the Theravada originated at the first council, right after the Buddha passed away, you know? Second thing, that Sri Lankan Theravada is and always has been a descendant of only this early Buddhism. Yeah. And three, that the Mahavihara was the original and true upholder of these teachings. So all that is being questioned. What does the footnote say? Oh. Okay, whatever the historical truth may be, the Theravada is a noble Buddhist tradition that has inspired faith in millions of people, led to their individual betterment and the improvement of society, and produced many highly realized holy beings. Okay, yeah?
I just wondered if you had talked with any modern Bay, probably our Western friends, Theravada friends, about Buddhaghosa and their attitude towards him. Because when I was at the monastic gathering, I was surprised. It seemed like they were. I thought they all held him and like everything he said is the word of God.
Yeah.
But they didn't hold him that way.
Yeah.
I was surprised and I wondered if you had any conversations.
Yeah, I have. And, you know, in my correspondence with some of my Theravada monk friends, because I too, you know, thought that, you know, Buddhaghosa, I mean, he's the one who made all these commentaries and systematized so much and put the, you know, the ancient Sinhala commentaries together, and so I thought that everybody followed him. And I too have been very surprised that some of the monks who are also very scholarly, they really make a difference between early Buddhism and the later commentaries. And they say that, you know, what the Buddha taught in the sutras and what the commentarial tradition has are often different. And so some of them are, you know, very much, I'm just paying attention to the early Buddhist texts and especially the sutras, yeah, or maybe very early commentaries. But, you know, many of them, you know, Buddhaghosa is too late and, you know, by the time you get even to the 10th century, you know, that's, you know, far beyond them. Yeah, so I was surprised to hear the same thing. Yeah. Okay, but I don't know how prevalent that is or if that is mostly by the ones who are more scholarly, you know, because, and then also among my Theravada monk friends, there are some who study a lot and some who don't study very much. Yeah.
So Bhikkhu Bodhi quotes Buddhaghosa consistently.
Bhikkhu Bodhi?
Quotes him when in his translations.
He quotes him, but he also distinguishes them from the early Buddhism. Yeah. And because sometimes I'll write and I'll ask him a question. You know, what does the tradition say about this? And he'll say, well, the early Buddhists say this, and then the later commentaries say that. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sure you could say the same in our tradition because, you know, we have the Indian commentators, but then you have the Tibetans who wrote commentaries on the Indians. And, you know, first of all, the Indian commentaries don't all agree with each other, and the Tibetan commentaries on certain Indian texts have a wide variation of interpretation. And then the monastics, monastic yikchas, who look at even Tsongkhapa's writings, have different interpretations about that. So, yeah, you have that thing going on. But then also, do you remember Li Shanghai, my friend? So I think we have his PhD. Yeah, it's very interesting because he talks about how the further away we get from the original source of the religion, that people always refer back to the source, but they tend to study and have more faith in the more recent commentaries. Yeah. Which is interesting, yeah. But the more recent commentaries actually then have, well, perhaps it's because the people who wrote them are more thinking in line with the culture at that time, yeah. But then it also, you know, creates many interpretations that can be removed from the original thing. Yeah. So, I mean, on one hand, the commentaries flesh out all these things that you would probably never think of before. On another hand, then if you are taught follow these commentaries and don't follow those commentaries, then sometimes maybe your mind just can get narrow too. And stop thinking about, you know, different possibilities of what, what the original sutras said, or even the early Indian commentaries.
Science, when I studied social science, they criticized us because at our time the students started to read only commentaries, not the original sociologist or political scientists.
And especially in religion, when authenticity is traced back to the origin, yeah, then you have to have some ways of validating your commentaries as relating to the origin. In social science, you have a little bit more flexibility because nobody's saying it came from God or Buddha or somebody else. But in religion, you know, you have to be able to tie it back to the original thing. But then you still wind up with all these different meanings of things, some of which are very, very different. You know? And on one hand, that's wonderful. That's why you have so much debate, and debate means people are thinking about things. Yeah, so on one hand, that's good. On the other hand, it could be just things dispersing and, you know, getting out of hand. So who knows?